This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Hello, good morning. I'm Noelle Lim. Today we speak with Amy Morris, the CEO of Maybank Kim Eng, the investment banking arm of Maybank. With offices in over 10 countries in ASEAN, US and the UK, Maybank Kim Eng is the largest stockbroking house in this region. What will be its next growth catalyst? We will find out from Amy. Thank you for speaking with us. So last December, Maybank Kim Eng had cut 3 to 5% of its workforce in Singapore, and in January closed its institutional research business in Hong Kong. And I understand the rationale is to invest in emerging opportunities in new growth areas. What are these areas?
When we talk about the future, it's really within what is more realistic is within the next 12 months. Actually, the growth catalyst for us is that we expect to see a prolonged low interest rate environment where clients will be looking to issue new debt for longer duration. And with that, the debt capital market space will remain very active as clients take advantage of this outlook. And naturally, also over the next 2 to 3 years, as economies start to recover, the number of M&A opportunities will also likely to emerge in a much stronger fashion, right? As difficult as companies start to exit perhaps non-core businesses to focus on capital and management time on their core businesses. And also a slower growth environment is likely to lead to declining profitability. And some companies that are highly leveraged may not survive. These are all possible acquisition targets for larger players to consolidate the market.
But why did you close your institutional research business in Hong Kong then?
Hong Kong is a very competitive market globally, naturally. And what the intention was really for us to be very ASEAN focused, definitely over the last 10 years, as we have grown to be one of ASEAN's larger, if not the largest, homegrown investment banks. And so the ambition then is to ensure that our exposure, our coverage in markets where we don't have physical presence in a very robust way, for example, in North Asia and in China, we will expand via strategic partnerships. In May 2019, for example, we signed a strategic partnership with ICBC International Securities, which belongs to the one of the largest global banks, ICBC.
What other opportunities do you see, like, say, in the Middle East?
The Middle East is not a part of our focus geography at this point in time, although the bank has recently opened its presence in Dubai.
And why is it not a priority? I'm thinking that for the Islamic bond market, for example, wouldn't the Middle East be strategic for Maybank Kim Eng?
Our focus is truly to be an ASEAN investment bank. We consider ASEAN to be a huge growth geography with close to 650 million people. Where we want to position ourselves, we need to be where we have the best competitive advantage. And this competitive advantage really comes in the shape of our parent bank, Maybank. We compete where we really feel that we have a right to win.
So what Maybank Kim Eng is doing is really sticking to its core. But, you know, I do wonder, though, why wouldn't Maybank Kim Eng want to expand further? After all, it has Islamic investment advisory capabilities. You can offer that in the Middle East. And as I see it, you know, after Saudi Aramco's listing and the fact MSCI is adding more Saudi Arabian stocks into its emerging market indices, and possibly more companies are going to be listed coming out of Saudi Arabia, more Islamic debt will be raised. Why wouldn't Maybank want to, you know, really tap on that franchise and bring its services to the Middle East?
You know, at most geographical blocks are extremely competitive. They will have their own, capital market players who understand the market landscape a lot better. Just as we understand ASEAN, especially in terms of ASEAN liquidity, a lot better. The modus operandi would really be to leverage the bank's presence in Dubai which was set up and established earlier in this year, where the overall group will be working collaboratively in terms of products and client coverage to be able to cover clients across geographies. But the core product capabilities would naturally sit with us as investment banking product platform.
At this point, it sounds to me the strategy is quite business as usual. It's about just doing what you're really good at. It's almost quite a defensive strategy. But I'm just wondering whether it's a strategy that will really strengthen Maybank's position for the next 10 years. Because all it takes is another Chinese investment bank to come into this region in a big way. And they have the balance sheet size. And also fintech companies coming into the picture. And they have the mind share of millennial customers and more superior trading systems. What will be your next real game changer for Maybank?
You know, when we are dealing with liquidity, as we are as an investment bank, whilst, of course, competition is intensifying, particularly within the digital space, that is really much more relevant to our market-facing business. I think when you're talking about digitization on one hand and then the size of balance sheet on the other, there are two, in a way, can be taken separately. In terms of digital competition, yes, we are very cognizant. That is why we have continuously invested in people to ensure that our people understand clients' needs and in ensuring the kind of best digital experience and convenience. And naturally, we are always looking out for technology investments and technology partnerships as the requirement for specialization increases. Going back to your question on perhaps not being competitive vis-a-vis the Chinese investment banks and players with larger balance sheets, that is where our strategy of ensuring we have a strong, robust suite of strategic partnerships across the globe will put us in good state to make sure that whilst we are able to serve the domestic ASEAN markets, we are also able to offer the opportunities in other markets. For example, as mentioned, through our partnership with ICBCI, with the likes of Mizuho, with Cathay, and with Daishin in North Asia, which are naturally markets to be focused on.
And wouldn't potential Chinese competitors have this kind of global partnerships and maybe even more?
Yes, but we are the only ASEAN investment bank that has signed a strategic partnership with ICBCI, which as I've mentioned, is one of the largest global banks in the world.
In terms of the stockbroking business, that could be the most vulnerable. Just looking at some numbers here, I think, say, in Malaysia, I think over 200,000 trading accounts were opened in 2020, and 75% of it was for online brokers, and some names come to mind are like Rakuten. They only charge like 7 ringgit or 10 ringgit per trade. How will you continue to grow your stockbroking franchise?
We are very cognizant of the coming on board of not only the millennials, but also Gen Z. In terms of what kind of advice that we can bring to the table for our clients, because ultimately returns, or what we call alpha, has become extremely scarce globally with all the different types of variables that investments need to deal with. So with our deep, us being in the marketplace for a very long time, we have one of the largest research teams in the region. We really do understand what the different ASEAN markets, what makes them tick, what makes the growth drivers, the risks to be navigated. And so this kind of advice, which is what we call on the high end of touch, I don't think will be something that some client segments will necessarily want to do without, because ultimately it is the quality of advice that will ensure the best investment returns for clients.
What I understand, clients are quite generational. So maybe the older clients, the high net worth clients, they like this high touch approach, people seeing them, giving them some advice. And what I understand, the younger customers are more digitally savvy and they like to be more exploratory and more experimental. And as we know, in the digital world, technology can just outrun human beings, right, in terms of capabilities. And you see that younger clients are very interested in investing through online portals. Given this kind of dynamics, how will Maybank navigate, build more mindshare and wallet share among the millennials, the TikTok generation or the Gen Z?
Gen Zs also grow up, right? And Gen Zs will have more disposable income. Gen Zs will want, as I've mentioned, you know, better, well-grounded advice. Although they may be self-directed, they want all the digital tools to be able to wake up in the morning to see their portfolio first thing, to be able to get the top 10 best ideas. All investment banks, especially Maybank Kim Eng, we are extremely on the curve in understanding what clients need. I don't think that, and I don't believe that we are not competitive, but the proposition is to be competitive in a fairly different way. And that as Gen Zs grow up, they will have more demands on their time. They will want better high-touch service and be able to speak to somebody, perhaps not face-to-face, but certainly have conversations, you know, on devices, etc., but still have a higher level and intensity of interaction in order to make lifelong investment decisions, which, you know, could involve retirement savings, etc. People still need to have that kind of high-touch interface.
How do we know for sure the Gen Z will be like the baby boomers of our generation? They grow up differently. They are digital natives.
That's a very pertinent point. I have always said, how do we know what the conversations that we are having today will be relevant for sure? The reason why we emphasize our people first strategy. People need to be on the game. It's our people who need to be on the ball to understand, to see where the evolution of clients' demands and imperatives are, to be able, you know, to drive the bus in the right direction, and to make sure that, you know, execution is how it is planned. So it always comes back to me. We can always talk about technology, Noel, right? And trust me, in all boardrooms today, every day, people are debating, discussing, you know, about how do we compete with technology. My position, and, you know, fairly aligned with the group's position, sometimes it's not about the technology we have. It's about making sure we have the right people on the bus, in the right seats, at the right time, understanding the right landscape.
On The Breakfast Grill, I'm speaking with Amy Morris, CEO of Maybank Kim Eng, the investment banking arm of Maybank Group. As the bank is focused on recruiting the right people, we will discuss why talent would want to join the banking group instead of a technology company. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. Amy Morris, CEO of Maybank Kim Eng, joins us today. If given a choice between working for a financial technology company like Ant Financial and Maybank Group, I am guessing that most top talent will gravitate towards Ant. It's far larger, has sexier growth prospects, and is investing in the future. How will you attract good talent?
And whilst everything looks fairly sexy with Ant Financial and TikTok and the likes, you cannot take away also the fact that, you know, organizations like us have been around for decades. There is huge, deep financial stability that we offer. The governance in terms of the transparency of what we do and what the plans are over a longer term are all very, very clear. They are two different business models. They are two different separate types of businesses that an Ant Financial is in compared to what Maybank Kim Eng as an investment bank is in. It doesn't take one away from the other. Partnerships are being struck everywhere. I think you can, as you probably may know, Maybank has a partnership with Grab, and these are the things that various entities will need to do to bring together collaboration, to harness each other's strengths, and to develop more opportunities ultimately for organizations and as well as consumers.
But when I just look at the stock market valuations, it's the tech companies that are driving market valuations. And I'm wondering whether that companies who don't put enough emphasis on technology, are they going to be the ones losing out?
It's more about how technology and which technologies we should deploy given, you know, our competitive advantage, where we have come from and where we are headed. Organizations with their own distinct history cannot be digitally native overnight. And that, I don't think, would be a very serious consideration. There are many types of capital market players that will be required. Those that perhaps understand liquidity, for example, in a much more intense manner, understand how the market dynamics are shaped. Those will always be perennial considerations in any kind of marketplace. So, you know, yes, the current retail-driven liquidity rally globally, where we have seen the huge performance in, you know, the big technology stocks, similarly in the local markets, these are thematic plays for sure, given the current environment of COVID, and where people realize how imperative it is to be able to be digital. I'm not saying that they are short-term plays. These are definitely going to be more permanent thematics that will shape market forces. But big organizations everywhere are doing and are definitely shaping their own conversations to remain relevant and to ensure that they understand which technologies really make sense and really pays in the end.
So zooming out and just trying to understand what's happening in the bigger world, what are clients telling you? I mean, are they worried about the economy and when do they see recovery?
What is fairly clear and what we are hearing from clients is that 2021 will be the year where the expectation of recovery will happen. Albeit, of course, it will not be smooth sailing. There will be periods when there will be localized and targeted lockdowns as until the point where there is a vaccine for global immunity. So in terms of where clients are headed, I think that is also part of the reason where you see in most of the domestic markets in ASEAN, it is very much retail liquidity that is in the marketplace. Given very low interest rate environments, it just makes sense for retail investors to take some portion of their available funds and income to actually make direct investments into the market themselves.
And given this retail-driven rally, will our stock market run end in tears like in 1997 or the dot-com bubble, the risk of that?
The sentiment that we get from the ground certainly is that, you know, as retail investors have enjoyed some capital appreciation, the tendency is for them to then plow it back into the market. So it remains to be seen whether it ends in tears, but I guess what is shaping their behavior is the expectation that global interest rates outlook will remain lower and for longer.
And if, say, we don't see a firm recovery in 2021, do you think the stock market will continue on its run?
What we have seen globally, while perhaps there has been a lack of global concerted action in dealing with the social impact, for example, or the health impact from the pandemic, all regulators and stakeholders need to ensure that, you know, the markets are able to fully function in its primary purpose of providing capital and funding avenues without damaging any particular segment's interest.
Right, so it's really incumbent on the regulators to ensure the market does not overheat while maintaining the ability for the market to discover prices.
Oh, trust me, all regulators everywhere are extremely on board. We all know the negative impact that if anything untoward were to happen to, for example, the retail investors, retail liquidity, and hence that is where the continuous process of educating the new to investing client segments. Whilst we are all very happy to have very convenient digital tools, the likes of Robinhood, for example, ultimately, it is organizations and regulators taking responsibility and very deep responsibility for the safety, for the protection of investors across marketplaces.
The last few years in Malaysia have not been easy due to political changes. And what are you telling foreign investors to convince them Malaysia still has potential?
You know, whilst domestically, we talk a lot about the political changes in our government, for global investors, this is par for the course of any market. Most markets will go through different types of transitions, different types of changes. As long as governments are clear about policies in terms of economic growth, in terms of the well-being of people. You know, I think when the overall uncertainties around COVID does settle down, hopefully with the vaccine, the introduction of a vaccine sometime either at the end of the year or the beginning of 2021, flows into emerging markets as a whole will return. I think that we shouldn't just see Malaysia as an isolated marketplace. It is very much congruent with global flows out of emerging markets into more mature markets, into US dollar assets. And at some point in time, when things balance out, those same funds will flow back into emerging markets, including this region.
About two decades ago, Malaysia's stock market size was about similar to Singapore. Now, Malaysia has been overtaken by Singapore. What is this telling us about Malaysia's underlying economy and maybe even state of entrepreneurship that is supposed to be creating this pipeline of IPO listings? Are Malaysia's best years behind it?
As an investment bank, MKE is very much an ASEAN bank. So in that sense, I think Malaysian companies are doing the same. So in that sense, yes, whilst you know our market capitalization may have remained stagnant, I think there are many homegrown Malaysian companies that are already becoming truly regional. And perhaps you know that is where we will see the opportunities over the next few years, where they develop the kinds of entrepreneurship, the kinds of homegrown businesses, and really focus on things like technology enablement to bring back, to really harness that value within the Malaysian market.
Thank you for speaking with us. Amy Morris, CEO of Maybank Kim Eng Group. I'm Noelle Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.